You're listening to a sermon by Charis Weathers, recorded on Sunday, February 28, 2010, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, thanks a ton for having me here today. I've heard about this little church from Rosie quite a lot, actually, so it's, thank you for having me. For about the past month, I have been a volunteer chaplain with the Olympics, so I've been based in the Whistler Athletes Village, available for those who need spiritual counsel or whatever, and we would hold devotionals for the athletes and officials and occasionally volunteers, whoever wanted to partake of those. And I know that people have different opinions about the games. I know that there are very few people who actually benefit from the games, and those who do benefit financially benefit a lot. And there's a ton of people out there who actually just get shafted by the games. So I know it's a very complex type of institution, but I have been captured by the Olympics since I was a kid, just being able to watch the sports. And all I really have to do is to watch a highlight or a lowlight reel, and you put some schmarmy music with it, and I'm usually basically a puddle. It just, you know, just like, oh, this is so amazing. It is the height of drama for me. You've got the pinnacle of just absolute celebration and joy, and you've got the depths of despair if someone falls or if they just don't perform like they thought they were going to. You can have the female skeleton person representing Canada who apologizes to the entire country for coming in fifth. I mean, that's a pretty depth. That's a big depth right there. And the cameras are trained on the athletes every moment, so you get to see them walk through this height and this despair every moment. They can't really hide from the press. It is drama at its best, and sometimes worse, but it is a lot of drama. And the text we're going to look at today in the Gospel of John is also filled with a lot of drama. It is drama at its best. It contains a very strong element of the hope of this ultimate victory, but at the same time, it also contains the anguish of extreme personal loss. In our context, which this passage is only one part of, is the story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, and we're only getting the middle section of it. If you're familiar with this story, you know that Jesus had received word that his very good friend Lazarus was ill. Now, instead of rushing to the scene, Jesus had waited a few days before visiting the family, and by which time, Lazarus has already died. Now, when we come on the scene in verse 17, Jesus arrives in Lazarus' hometown, where he's greeted by Lazarus' sisters, Mary and Martha, who also happen to be good friends of Jesus. So that's kind of what's going on in the story. And I think I'm going to read it again, just to give us another chance to be in it, because this story is going to form the basis for this entire message today. So John 11, verses 17 to 37. I'm going to read out of the TNIV, but it's very similar to yours. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Mary and Martha to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." And Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." And Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she told him, "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who was to come into the world." And after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher is here," she said, "and is asking for you." Now, when Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now, Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. And Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" There's a lot in this story. In verse 17, we read that Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. In Jewish custom, fully dead people have been dead for 4 days. For the first 3 days, the soul would hang around the body, and then on the fourth day, the soul would move on. Lazarus is not just mostly dead, kind of like the guy in the Monty Python movie. "I'm not dead yet." He is completely, totally dead. It's been 4 days. And somehow Martha receives word that Jesus is coming. And apparently, without telling her sister Mary, she goes out to meet Jesus. And she says, verse 21 and 22, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. Lord, if you had been here, if you had been here, Lazarus would not have died. If you had been here, Lazarus would be fine, and we wouldn't have to be mourning my brother and your good friend. If you had been here, if you had been here, Jesus, if only you had been here." When Martha goes back to her sister Mary to tell her that Jesus is in town and asking for her, Mary's comment is identical. Mary says, "Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died." Their words are so similar. You know these two ladies have been talking to each other. You know they've been evaluating this whole thing. Where is Jesus? We've seen him heal people. We know that he's able to do something about sickness and illness. Where is he? Why didn't he come to us? We are important to him, aren't we? If only you had been here, Jesus. If only. If only. These aren't just the words of Mary and Martha, are they? These are words that echo throughout the world every single day. If only. These are words that are common to every single person that I know, and they're certainly common to me. If God had only protected the luge guy, after all, it was only a very small error that he committed. If only God had to do just some small little thing. If only God had done this or had done that, then I wouldn't have suffered. Then my loved ones wouldn't have suffered. Then my family would still be intact. Then my world wouldn't have fallen apart. Then my child wouldn't have been hurt. Then I wouldn't have lost my job. Then I would have gotten into med school. Then my spouse wouldn't have had an affair. Then I wouldn't feel the despair that I feel now that I never thought was possible. If only, God, where were you? You had the power to change these circumstances if only you had shown up. I deeply, deeply value this text because of the honesty of Mary and Martha. I don't think that they knew unequivocally that they were talking to God. If they were, they probably would have responded a little bit differently. Just grit your teeth, here he comes. "Hi, Jesus, it's so good to have you here." But they just lay it out on the line. Jesus is their good friend, and they have had this bitter, bitter disappointment. They are not happy with Jesus. And even if there was no way that Jesus could have gotten there in time to do anything about it, which from the text that appears to be the case, that didn't matter. The math didn't matter to Mary and Martha. Logic rarely helps when your heart is bleeding and broken. After Martha tells Jesus her brother wouldn't have died if only he had been there, she then says in verse 22, "But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." Now, at first glance, this looks like Martha already knows that Jesus can raise Lazarus from the dead. But later evidence in the text makes this a bit unlikely. She might have been saying, hey, I know you didn't save Lazarus, but I know that it is possible that God will do for you whatever you ask of him. Which could also be a little bit of more of a dig. If you'd been here, God would have healed him. All you had to do was ask him, because you've got that power. And now Jesus has a turn to speak. He says to her, your brother will rise again. And Martha says, yeah, I know that. Lazarus is going to rise again in the resurrection on the last day. In other words, Lazarus is going to rise in that really big event when all the other dead people are going to rise again too. Thanks, Jesus. I know. It's a response to one of those well-meaning statements of comfort that just aren't able to make you feel that much better. It's kind of like when someone says to a grieving person that their loved one is in a better place. The person will likely respond, yeah, I know, but deep down it doesn't really help at the moment. It's well-meaning and it's true, but it doesn't really help at the moment. But as is so often the case, Jesus didn't really mean what Martha thought he meant. He does this a lot. Jesus gives her some further information that is only going to make sense at a much later time. Verses 25 and 26, Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. It's one of the most remarkable statements in all of Scripture. Martha, the resurrection that you're thinking of isn't just some thing, some event that's going to happen in the future. This resurrection is me. Life is found in me. If you believe in me, then you're going to live on. You don't actually experience death. You're going to have a physical death, but it's not an end, because you have me, and I contain life. I am life. Resurrection isn't some thing. It is a person. Can you imagine hanging out with this guy, Jesus, who is life? He isn't just alive, and he doesn't just bring people back to life. He is the life. The life is in him. It is contained in him. It is embodied in him. This man, this person right now who is talking to Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. I am this. And he says to her, do you believe this? Do you think Martha has any idea, any clue that she knows what Jesus is talking about here? I wouldn't have if I was in her shoes. We can look back and have an idea of what he's talking about because we're able to connect the dots in Jesus' life, in this mysterious life of Jesus. But she doesn't have that luxury to be able to look back on what happens afterwards. But she actually really does answer him well here. Verse 27, yes, Lord, she told him, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who was to come into the world. Now, this does fall short of the ginormous truth that Jesus has just spoken, but there is a ton of faith in this woman here. This woman, we might add, who has just recently lost her brother and is bitterly disappointed that Jesus wasn't there to save him. She speaks this awesome truth to Jesus, and then she heads right off to find her sister. Now, maybe it was just a little too intense of a conversation. I certainly wouldn't have wanted to have been in her shoes getting those kinds of questions from Jesus, these metaphysical questions about big things of life from the creator of the universe. I think I would have been going to find my sister or just about anybody else to talk to at that point in time. Jesus, I really would have just liked to know why you weren't here. I don't know about all these questions about who you are. So Martha tells Mary, her sister, to go to Jesus. And Mary has her own time of saying to Jesus, if only you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. But we are told, though, that as Mary asks this question, she is weeping. Martha may have been weeping, too, but the text doesn't tell us that. And a bunch of people had gone with Mary when she ran out of the house to meet Jesus, and they are all weeping, too. Jewish burials required 7 full days of mourning for the person who had died. This involved lots of tears. It involved lots of wailing. It was customary for families to hire people to be loud mourners. There was lots and lots of physical outpouring of grief, and it's day 4 of the 7 days of mourning. This was not a funeral or a memorial service like we have today when everyone tries their best to be quiet. The respect that our culture in the West shows in quietness was shown in loudness there. It's just a flip. It's a reverse. And the weeping, it wouldn't have been small sniffles and a wadded up tissue. It is loud, belly loudness going on there. And the text says that in the midst of this, Jesus has a reaction. When he sees this weeping, he is deeply moved in spirit and troubled. And a better translation would reveal Jesus as quite angry. There's a lot of speculation as to why Jesus is angry here, but possibly the best explanation goes back to what he just said to Martha. He contains, he embodies life itself, and yet people, his really, really good friend Lazarus, people still die. People are still dying because God's purposes and plans have not yet been fully revealed or put into place. He can say, "I'm the resurrection and life," but nobody even knows what that means yet. He's likely angry at death itself and its hold over creation. He is life. He is resurrection. But death is not yet completely overcome. Not yet. And Jesus asks where the tomb is, and we get the shortest verse of the Bible. I think it's maybe 4 words in the NRSV, but it's 2 in the TNIV. Jesus wept. It's intriguing to me that this is the shortest verse of the Bible. It could have been anything else, put any 2 words together. But the actual power of these 2 together, Jesus wept. He cried. And I don't think it was the wimpy little tears in the wadded up tissue. I think it was a ball that just comes from the gut and spills over. It could have been similar to what Joanie Rochette would have been able to do if she had the freedom to actually express in public how she was feeling about the loss of her mom, maybe. I think Jesus actually might have been a bit stronger here. It's so loud, his weeping, that people around him comment on how much he must have loved Jesus. This is loud weeping. He really loved this man. There are some scenes in movies that make me cry every time I see them. I don't know if that's true of anybody else here, but I can watch the movie tons of times. When you get to a certain scene, it just makes me cry. Most of them have to do with the death of a protagonist. Beaches, Steel Magnolias, wow, total chick flicks that just make me cry. But one of the most poignant that isn't quite a chick flick, it can relate to both men and women, is in The Two Towers, the second movie of the Lord of the Rings series, which is a phenomenal series. Gandalf, while protecting the hobbits and their party from the attack of this enormous, evil, dangerous, wicked Balrog, he plunges off of a bridge. In fighting this Balrog, they both fall off of this bridge, and Gandalf plunges to what appears to be his death. Now, the hobbits watch this, and they are instantly despondent. Gandalf has saved them, and he has now fallen to his death. They are desperate in their panicked anguish, and they have to be literally carried out of the cave in which this just happened. They are crying, they are wailing for their guardian, for their hero, and for their friend. And this scene gets me every time. Peter Jackson, the director, just captured it so well. The unadulterated grief that is etched all over Frodo's face as he is wailing, being literally carried out of the cave. And I can feel just a little shadow of what they might feel, because we've gotten a chance to get to know Gandalf through this whole process as well in these movies. Maybe I'm just a mess in movies, I don't know. Don't go to an emotional movie with me. But really, we know that Gandalf doesn't die. If we know the story, we know that he doesn't die. And hopefully I didn't give it away for anyone who's been saving the movie series. Gandalf doesn't really die. He comes back, even better than before, to save the day in the end. I know that. But I still cry at this bridge scene. I still cry. The pain of death does not simply go away because we know there is a better end. The pain of death does not go away simply because we know there is a better end. Jesus was near the grave of a very dear friend, a friend who went through physical suffering and illness to the point of dying. Sure, there will be resurrection, but Jesus feels the pain, this loss of a good friend, and I'm not so sure that he had that many good, close friends. Some scholars and commentators kind of tend to focus in on this is evidence of Jesus' human side in this passage. And I don't think that's the best idea. I don't think that's the best direction for us to go in. It's too easy to think this is just Jesus' humanity crying out here for the loss of his friend. It has to be both his human and his divine natures. You can't separate out these two natures. There is no separating out the human form from the divine form in Jesus. He is one person who is fully human and fully divine. There is just as much Jesus, the member of the Trinity, crying here as it is God, the man, Jesus. What we have here is a picture of God weeping over his dead friend. And the people around him at this time ask aloud the same question that Jesus got from these two sisters. This is the third time this question has been asked. Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Look how much he loved him. Couldn't he have done something? If only Jesus, if only you had been here. And while these questions are being asked, we see Jesus in tears at the loss of his friend. So where is God in the midst of our if-onlys? In this story, he is right in the middle of those who are asking the if-only question. He is there. He's not separate. He waited to get to Lazarus' home for a specific reason, but he is not aloof. He is not removed. He's going to show his power and reveal that indeed he can do something about Lazarus' condition by raising him from the dead. But right now, right here, he is a broken-hearted God-man. This is the image that we have of Jesus. This is the image we have of a God who holds all of the if-onlys that every person in this world asks. This is the image we have of this God who holds these if-onlys, and he stands and weeps at the loss of his friend. There aren't many answers in this text today. Although we can understand that Jesus' delay of getting to Bethany, Lazarus' town, his delay in this passage is so that Jesus' identity can be revealed. But quite often in our own lives, we don't have this clear revelation of what God is doing. And possibly nowhere else in Scripture do we have such a striking picture of Jesus, of God, weeping with the pain of searing loss. Now, while we may not get many answers about why things happen in our own lives, why things happen in this church, in this city, in this world, we do not have a God who is uninvolved. We have a God who is present at the very core of his divine being. Somehow, in the mystery of this faith, we have a God who simultaneously holds the power over death, simultaneously holds this power over death, embodying life, and at the same time weeps over the pain and loss that is integral to the human condition. He holds both of these. I am the resurrection and the life. Jesus wept. This is the same scene. It's the same man. And we have this phrase, if only, and this is the image that we have in the midst of this if only. Now, we might hold this phrase, if only, so quietly and silently so that no one in the world can ever know that we carry it. And I think for some, the reason is there's a fear that if we actually ask this question out loud, if only, God might not have an answer to it. And that might be true. We may not ever get the questions of our disappointment with God answered, but we do have an image. We have an image. We have an image of Jesus weeping, ready to raise the dead, yet caught up in the grief that will require the reply of resurrection that he embodies. This is our God, this man, this one who embodies and who simultaneously holds both life and the experience of deep, deep loss. So take heart. We are not alone. Our tears, our many tears, have company. And our tearful companion, the Savior of the world, has the power to overcome pain and death. Thanks be to God. Amen.